This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Chuck Ferreter of Claremont, California, our guest today. And I want to thank a longtime listener for connecting us to his friend Chuck. Drew Miller listened to Hometown Heroes for years on our affiliate in Salem, Oregon, KYKN, before he moved down to Southern California, where he got to know this nonagenarian with a story that is really remarkable. Just to give you a taste of what's to come with this Merchant Marine veteran, let me read this brief excerpt from his book about a tragic run-in with a dog-leg crane during the Korean War. The load in this new pick was swinging dangerously wide and would hit crew members on the deck. When Chuck heard the "look out" shouts, he turned to see the load only a couple of arm's lengths away and was coming on quickly. He made the decision that both he and Frank had to jump over the ship's railing to escape. He shouted to Frank, "Frank, we've got to go over the side. We should land safely in the water." Chuck jumped immediately. He found himself lying on his side in the air in the temporary safety of the space beyond the bulwark of the ship. He couldn't see him, but he hoped that Frank was there with him. Again, that's from his book, In the Gentle Blue Light of the Dog Star, and you're going to hear Chuck describe that incident in his own words before we're done today.
Well, by then I had developed some skills, and I was qualified as an able seaman, and then the picture that's in the, I'm a quartermaster by then, and then a chief quartermaster. The chief quartermaster is a good job. You're responsible for the whole bridge, all the equipment, maintain it, and fix whatever's wrong or replace it.
And where did that hospital ship go?
Literally everywhere. We always went to a place to get the doctors. They went usually one trip at a time. We'd pick them up, doctors and nurses, and the equipment that they needed. It all had to be fresh. We'd take them to whatever the thing they were going to and bring them home again and take new ones to someplace else. By then, World War II was over. Duty didn't change at all. We were still doing the same thing, dashing here and dashing there with supplies. And then when Korea came along, that changed things again, but only slightly. We were sent back to California to get the 1st Marine Division from Camp Pendleton. And we took them to that port at the south end of the peninsula. It was called Busan. As soon as the Marines got there, these North Koreans knew that the fun was over. They thought, what's going on here? These guys aren't afraid of us. After just a couple of weeks, they had leveled that thing out, the Marine Corps, and they got back on Navy transports and went to Incheon and landed, and the North Koreans, they didn't want to get cut off, so they couldn't get home. So they ran home. They literally ran home. And the war was over, technically, because the UN orders were to dispel the North Korean troops from South Korea. But Doug, General MacArthur, it was quoted in Life magazine, he wanted to poke a stick in the eye of the Chinese commies. So he sent the 8th Army, sent the 1st American Marines, 1st Division, around to the East Coast to Hang Nam, and they went on our ship. We put them ashore there, and they went up the hill and disappeared. And I guess the second day, they're in the area of the Chosin Reservoir. When they woke up in the morning, instead of the hills being white with snow, they were brown with a couple of armies of Chinese soldiers. And they fought their way out. They just turned around and fought their way back to the coast. And as soon as they got to that hill, we saw them go over. Of course, we knew what was happening by radio.
And did you guys have to stay there to prepare for casualties?
That's right. We were there to supply them. Actually, they were headed for the other edge of Korea, which was the Chinese border.
Right.
And that was MacArthur's order. Anyway, they fought their way back up to the top of that hill. And once they were over it, the Chinese didn't come because they knew we had Navy ships down there that could hit them. So they never came over the hill. So the Marines came down. We took them back to Busan. We were loaded full with North Korean civilians, men and women and little kids. They were just fleeing to get out. And when we got there, we had three babies, brand new little babies, left the North with X number and gained three on the way south. But the Marines then went back into line, and they were fighting Chinese. And that went on until it was over 3 years later.
And you're witnessing this from the deck of your ship?
Yeah.
So you're watching the lines move, and you're watching guys die.
We were always on the move, but we knew what was going on. You know, it's a big country, so we weren't seeing their battles with the Chinese. It's just out of sight. You know, when the Marines, when they come over that mountain, they had all of their dead and all of their casualties with them. They didn't leave a soul. That's remarkable.
Well, we're talking about the Korean War, but I don't want to leave out, you know, the chapter of World War II. You've got one brother who's in the Marines throughout. You have another brother who ends up wounded serving in the Army in Okinawa. And then you've got your own experience. Have you ever thought about what it must have been like for your mother to have three boys overseas in this war?
Yeah, she had a flag in the window with three stars on it.
And what happened to your younger brother?
He was, I think he called it the Ninth Army in Okinawa. And they were advancing into trenches that the Japanese had been in. And one morning, quarters were close. My brother saw a white phosphorus grenade, which I don't know whether the Japanese had them or not, but it was pretty much an American thing. And it was white phosphorus. It just burnt everything. If you put it on a desk, it'd burn a hole right through the desk. And he saw this thing land in front of him, thrown by some yahoo in the back of him.
One of his own guys.
Yeah, and didn't throw it far enough, and here it was. So he reached down to try to pick it up and throw it farther, and it exploded. They had to replace his eyelids and his nose, pieces of his cheeks and his hands. His buddy got him to an aid station, couldn't get his rifle out of his hands. It was welded into his hands. But eventually the medics got the rifle out of his hand. I think he went aboard the Navy hospital ship Comfort. Some general came aboard, and of course he was all in big white bandages and was knocked out because of the pain. So he didn't see anything, but they left his ribbons and his Purple Heart and all that stuff on a pillow on his bed.
Well, and you must have been still on your ship when you caught word of what had happened to him.
That's right. And my older brother was still there, too. I actually found out about it from home. Ed had been sent to Beaumont General Hospital in Texas, and my sister went down there to see him, and she told us about him. I'm sure Mom got a telegram or something, but no details. But we got the details from our sister. Poor kid was there for months with these endless operations. It takes a while to build an eyelid. I guess they build a little bit and then have to put more on it and then more. But you know that brave little kid and his hands, they were all burnt. But his clothes protected the rest of him, and his helmet protected his forehead, so he didn't have anything on his forehead, just what was exposed. Ed had a dog. By that time, our folks had sold off the cattle and were living in Broken Bow. They had retired and gone to town, literally. Mm-hmm. The old dog, ranch dogs really didn't get old. They rattlesnakes and big animals. There's too many things around to kill them, so they didn't last long. But this old dog, my mom decided to keep him alive until Eddie got home some way. He came home from the hospital with his coat with brass buttons and rawhide boots, and the old dog was there, and he sensed that he was blind, as old dogs all are, but he sensed that Ed was there. And he got up and walked over and sniffed his knee, decided that it was Ed and that everything was okay. So he laid down across his feet like he always did.
Well, and little did you know at the time the amount of time you'd be spending in hospitals and in operations. But what about the end of World War II? Because most of the people listening right now didn't live through this. How did you process that, or how significant a development was that for here a young merchant marine who's got a couple other brothers who've been fighting this war for a few years?
We were not philosophers. We didn't think a hell of a lot about it, I guess. We just dealt with each thing each day. I can't explain it any further than that. And I think we would have went nuts if we had tried to figure it all out.
Let me ask you this, Chuck. You proud of your two brothers?
Yep. I've written about them. They're just the bravest guys I know.
So you mentioned you served in the Merchant Marine during World War II and during the Korean War. And in between those two conflicts,
we were as busy as we were during the war.
Well, I believe it. And you also had a very significant development in your life come about.
Yeah.
It was very important that you end up meeting this person.
Yeah. The year must have been about 49. And I was at home. Anybody going to Nebraska, and this was in December, anybody going there takes clothes to stay warm.
Sure.
So I had the clothes I needed. But wouldn't you know, not the usual bad weather. It was called the Blizzard of 49. It killed thousands of cattle and reindeer and wild animals and hundreds of people. Anyway, I'm home there. I get on the train. It was called the City of Omaha, headed for Los Angeles. And I got on it, and it got about almost to North Platte. There are cottonwood trees all along the railroad, but they all disappeared. It was snowing so heavy that you couldn't see 2 feet ahead of you. And, of course, I got all my information in the bar. Anybody knows that.
On the train?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I went to the bar and asked the guy, I said, Pete, what the hell's going on? He said, you know, we're in a storm that nobody on this eastern slope has ever seen before. He said, there's a train up ahead of us, stopped and already frozen up. And he says, I don't know what's happening to those people on that. I couldn't worry about that. You just deal with the day that's ahead of you. There was a bar, a famous bar, across the street from the depot. They had a leather steer in there that had a saddle on him, and you got on him and you put a quarter in him, he would shake your eyebrows loose. He'd throw you across the room if you let go. So I spent several days both shooting and riding the bull. Eventually, we did get out of there, and what they did to get around that train that was stalled, they went down to Greeley, Colorado, on what they called the Beef Line. Must have been about the fourth or fifth day of the storm. This train that was up ahead of us, the village that they had stopped in, thank God they stopped in a village so that they'd have some place to go. The people on the train, there were 250 of them. They put them all in the depot in this little town called Hillsdale, Wyoming. Now that's like a 3-bedroom house with 300 people in it. There were no medical particular supplies. Nothing had been set aside to handle an emergency like that. But there were two nurses aboard that train that were headed for Honolulu to work. Mm. They had graduated from their nursing school in New Jersey, and they were on their way. When this thing happened, suddenly the only people responsible for 200 and some people, and they took it very seriously. They had pregnant women. They had old guys with heart attacks. They just dealt with whatever came up. Eventually, the railroad people got them out of that depot and put them into a schoolhouse and a church, which made conditions a lot better. People could breathe. Eventually, they started working on getting them out of there, and they got the idea of using those beef lines, and they sent buses to Greeley. And there were doctors in the buses when they came, so it released the girls, so they were free. They were able to go down to Greeley and catch their train to go.
The nurses finally got a break.
Yeah, they finally got a break. They were just so exhausted. They got to Greeley and were told, well, there's nobody here, but there's a train coming in, so that these two girls with most of their 300 people that they had literally saved were ready to go to California. And when I first saw them was the next morning when my train picked them up. There was a little Mormon lady. In those days, all the older people with white hair blued it, they called it. Even this little old Mormon lady had her hair blued. And I got acquainted with her. I took her to a movie in North Platte. It was a double feature, and she kept her hands over her eyes for the first one, which was a pretty brutal picture. But the next one was a musical with Hosea Turby playing the piano, and she loved it. Anyway, this little beautiful little old lady, she met these two girls, and she told them, there's a nice young man on the ship train that has a ship that's probably going to go to Hawaii, and he can probably give you a ride. This is all just dream stuff out of her head.
I was going to say, that's not usually the way those ships work.
Anyway, this pretty girl comes and sits down across the table. She says, we have a mutual friend, and he says that you have a boat that may be going to Hawaii. I said, I don't know what that person is drinking, but boats don't go to Hawaii. They go to Catalina, maybe, but it takes a ship to get to Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
This pretty girl stood up and says, well, I didn't come here to have a lecture in semantics, so I'm out of here. So I jumped up and ran after her and managed to save my butt, but it almost didn't work.
And it strikes me, Chuck, and at this time you don't know that you're going to marry this girl, that you're going to need her nursing skills and her care and her advocacy to survive what you are going to go through. But how many things had to happen? How many strings did the guy upstairs have to pull to get you two together?
Incredible. Just that so many things happen. More than coincidence. Huh? If you try to explain it all, you go crazy. So well, I just accept it.
And if you think the story of how Chuck and Muriel met is wild, wait till you hear what he had to survive before they could get married, and the role she played in helping him recover from physical and emotional injuries. Check out photos and video of Chuck at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.